to say, I am so very, very sorry, and have it heard. A lifelong dream. The scholars and foundations and disseminators never saw that his most serious wish was to entertain. Gately's not too agonized and feverish not to recognize gross self-pity when he hears it, wraith or no. As in the slogan, pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. With all due respect, pretty hard to believe this wraith could stay sober, if he needed to get sober, with a combination of abstraction and tragically misunderstood me attitude he's portraying in the dream. He'd been sober as a Mennonite quilter for 89 days, at the very tail end of his life, the wraith avers, now back up on the silent heart monitor, though Boston AA had a humorless, evangelical rabidity about it that had kept his attendance at meetings spotty. And he never could stand the vapid cliches and disdain for abstraction, not to mention the cigarette smoke. The atmosphere of the meeting rooms had been like a poker game in hell, had been his impression. The wraith stops and says he bets Gately's struggling to hide his curiosity about whether the wraith succeeded in coming up with a figurantless entertainment so thoroughly engaging it'd make even an in-bet figurant of a boy laugh and cry out for more. Father figure-wise, Gately's tried his best these last few sober months to fend off uninvited memories of his own grim conversations and interchanges with the MP. The wraith on the monitor now bends sharply at the waist, way over forward so his face is upside down only centimeters from Gately's face. The wraith's face is only about half the size of Gately's face and has no odor, and responds vehemently that, no, no, any conversation or interchange is better than none at all. To trust him on this, that the worst kind of gut-wrenching, intergenerational interface is better than withdrawal or hiddenness on either side. The wraith apparently can't tell the difference between Gately just thinking to himself and Gately using his brain voice to sort of think at the wraith. His shoulder suddenly sends up a flare of pain so sickening, Gately's afraid he might shit the bed. The wraith gasps and almost falls off the monitor, as if he can totally empathize with the dextral flare. Gately wonders if the wraith has to endure the same pain as Gately, in order to hear his brain voice and have a conversation with him. Even in a dream, that'd be a higher price than anybody's ever paid to interface with D.W. Gately. Maybe the pain's supposed to lend credibility to some diseased argument for Demerol the wraith's going to make. Gately feels somehow too self-conscious, or stupid, to ask the wraith if it's here on behalf of the higher power, or maybe the disease. So instead of thinking at the wraith, he simply concentrates on pretending to wonder to himself why the wraith is spending probably months of aggregate wraith time flitting around a hospital room and making pirouetted demonstrations with crooner photos and foreign tonic cans on the ceiling of some drug addict he doesn't know from a rock, instead of just quantuming over to wherever this alleged youngest son is and holding very still for wraith months and trying to have an interface with the fucking son. Though maybe thinking he was seeing his late organic dad as a ghost or wraith would drive the youngest son bats, though, might be the thing. The son didn't exactly sound like the steadiest hand on the old mental joystick as it was, from what the wraiths shared. Of course, this was assuming the mute figurant son even existed. This was assuming this wasn't all some roundabout way of the disease starting to talk Gately into succumbing to a shot of Demerol. He tries to concentrate on all this instead of remembering what Demerol's warm rush of utter well-being felt like, remembering the comfortable sound of the clunk of his chin against his chest. Or instead of remembering any of his own interchanges with his mother's live-in retired MP. One of the highest prices of sobriety was not being able to keep from remembering things you didn't want to remember. See, for instance, Ewell and the fraudulent grandiosity thing from his weenie-ish childhood. The XMP had referred to small children and toddlers as rugrats. It was not a term of gruff affection. The MP had made the toddler, Don Gately, return empty Heineken bottles to the neighborhood packy and then haul ass on back with the bottle deposits, timing him with a USN issue chronometer. He never laid a hand on Gately personally, that Don could recall, but he'd still been afraid of the MP. The MP'd beaten his mother up on an almost daily basis. The most hazardous time for Gately's mother was between 8 Heinekens and 10 Heinekens. When the MP threw her on the floor and knelt down very intently over her, picking his spots and hitting her very intently, he'd looked like a lobsterman pulling at his outboard's rope. The MP was slightly shorter than Mrs. Gately, but was broad and very muscular, and proud of his muscles, going shirtless whenever possible. Or in, like, sleeveless khaki military tees. He had bars and weights and benches, and had taught the child, Don Gately, the fundamentals of free weight training, with special emphasis on control and form as opposed to just sloppily lifting as much weight as possible. The weights were old and greasy, and their poundage pre-metric. The MP was very precise and controlled in his approach to things, in a way Gately has somehow come to associate with all blonde-haired men. When Gately, at age 10, began to be able to bench press more weight than the MP had not taken it in a good spirit and began refusing to spot him on his sets. The MP entered his own weights and repetitions carefully in a little notebook, pausing to do this after each set. He always licked the point of the pencil before he wrote, a habit Gately still finds repellent. In a different little notebook, the MP noted the date and time of each Heineken he consumed. He was the sort of person who equated incredibly careful record-keeping with control. In other words, he was by nature a turd counter. Gately had realized this at a very young age, and that it was bullshit, and maybe crazy. The MP was very possibly crazy. The circumstances of his leaving the Navy were, like, shadowy. When Gately involuntarily remembers the MP now, he also remembers and wonders why, and feels bad, that he never once asked his mother about the MP. And why the fuck was he even there? And did she actually love him? And why did she love him when he flung her down and beat her up on a more or less daily basis for fucking years on end? The intensifying rose colors behind Gately's closed lids are from the hospital room lightening as the light outside the window gets licoricey and pre-dawn. Gately lies below the unoccupied heart monitor snoring so hard the railings on either side of his bed shiver and rattle. When the MP was sleeping or out of the house, Don Gately and Mrs. Gately never once talked about him. His memory is clear on this. It wasn't just that they never discussed him, or the notebooks, or weights, or chronometer, or his beating up Mrs. Gately. The MP's name was never even mentioned. The MP worked nights a lot, driving a cheese and egg delivery truck for Cheese King Incorporated, until he was terminated for embezzling wheels of Stilton and fencing them. Then for a time on a mostly automated canning line, pulling a lever that sent New England chowder out of hundreds of spigots into hundreds of lidless cans with an indescribable plopping sound. And the Gately home was like a different world when the MP was working or out. It was like the very idea of the MP walked out the door with him, leaving Don and his mother not just behind, but alone, together, at night. She on the couch and he on the floor, both gradually losing consciousness in front of broadcast TV's final seasons. Gately tries especially hard now not to explore why it never occurred to him to step in and pull the MP off his mother, even after he could bench press more than the MP. The precise daily beatings had always seemed, in some strangely emphatic way, not his business. He rarely even felt anything, he remembers watching him hit her. The MP was totally unshy about hitting her in front of Gately. It was like everybody unspokenly agreed the whole thing was none of Bimmy's beeswax. When he was a toddler, he'd flee the room and cry about it, he seems to recall. By a certain age, though, all he'd do is raise the volume on the television, not even bothering to look over at the beating, watching Cheers. Sometimes he'd leave the room and go into the garage and lift weights, but when he left the room, it was never like he was fleeing the room. When he'd been small, he'd sometimes hear the springs and sounds from their bedroom sometimes in the AM and worry that the MP was beating her up on their bed. But at a certain point, without anybody taking him aside and explaining anything to him, he realized that the sounds then didn't mean she was getting hurt. The similarity of her hurt sounds in the kitchen and living room and her sex sounds through the asbestos fiberboard bedroom wall troubles Gately, though, when he remembers now, and is one reason why he fends off remembering when awake. Shirtless in the summer, and pale with a blonde man's dislike for the sun, the MP would sit in the little kitchen at the kitchen table, feet flat on the wood-grain tiling, with a patriotic-themed bandana wrapped around his head, recording Heineken's in his little notebook. A previous tenant had thrown something heavy through the kitchen window once, and the window's screen was fucked up and not quite flush, and houseflies came and went, more or less at will. Gately, when small, would be in there in the kitchen with the MP sometimes. The tile was better for his little car's suspensions than nubbly carpet. What Gately remembers, in pain, bubbling just under the lid of sleep, is the special and precise way the MP would handle the flies that came into the kitchen. He used no swatter or rolled cone of Harold. He had fast hands, the MP, thick and white and fast. He'd whack them as they lit on the kitchen table, the flies, but in a controlled way, not hard enough to kill them. He was very controlled and intent about it. He'd whack them just hard enough to disable them. Then he'd pick them up real precisely and remove either a wing or, like, a leg, something important to the fly. He'd take the wing or leg over to the beige kitchen wastebasket and very deliberately hike the lid with the foot pedal and deposit the tiny wing or leg in the wastebasket, bending at the waist. The memory is unbidden and very clear. The MP'd wash his hands at the kitchen sink using green generic dishwashing liquid. The maimed fly itself he'd ignore and allow to scuttle in crazed circles on the table until it got stuck in a sticky spot or fell off the edge onto the kitchen floor. The conversation with the MP that Gately re-experiences in minutely dreamed detail was the MP, at about 5 Heinekens, explaining that maiming a fly was way more effective than killing a fly. For flies. A fly was stuck in a sticky spot of dried Heineken and agitating its wing, as the MP explained, that a well-maimed fly produced tiny little fly screams of pain and fear. Human beings couldn't hear a maimed fly's screams, but you could bet your fat little rugrat ass other flies could, and the screams of their maimed colleagues helped keep them away. By the time the MP would put his head on his big, pale arms and grab a little shut-eye among the Heineken bottles on the sun-heated table, there'd often be several flies trapped in goo or scuttling in circles on the table, sometimes giving odd little hops, trying to fly with one wing or no wings. Possibly in denial, these flies, as to their, like, condition. The ones that fell to the floor, Gately would hunch directly over on hands and knees, getting one big red ear down just as close to the fly as possible, listening, his big pink forehead wrinkled. What makes Gately most uncomfortable now, as he starts to try to wake up in the lemon light of true hospital morning, is that he can't remember putting the maimed flies out of their misery, ever, after the MP passed out. Can't mentally see himself stepping on them, or wrapping them in paper towels and flushing them down the toilet or something. But he feels like he must have. It seems somehow real vital to be able to remember his doing something more than just hunkering blankly down amid his transformer cars and trying to see if he could hear tiny agonized screams, listening very intently. But he can't for the life of him remember doing more than trying to hear, and the sheer cerebral stress of trying to force a more noble memory should have awakened him on top of the dextral hurt. But he doesn't come all the way awake in the big crib until the memory's realistic dream bleeds into a nasty fictional dream where he's wearing Lentz's worsted topcoat and leaning very precisely and carefully over the prone figure of the Hawaiian-dressed nook whose head he's whacked repeatedly against the hood's windshield. He's supporting his inclined weight on his good left hand against the warm, throbbing hood, bent in real close to the maimed head, his ear to the bleeding face, listening very intently. The head opens its red mouth. The wet start Gately finally wakes with jars his shoulder inside and sends a yellow sheet of pain over him that makes him almost scream into the window's light. For about a year once, at age 20, in Malden, he'd slept most nights in a home-built loft in the dorm of a certain graduate RN nursing program in Malden, with a ragingly addicted RN nursing student in the loft, which you needed a 5-rung ladder to get up into this loft, and the thing was only a couple of feet under the ceiling, and every AM, Gately'd awake out of some bad dream and sit up with a jolt and thwack his head against the ceiling until, after some time, there was a permanent concavity in the ceiling and a flattish spot in the curve of the top of his forehead he can still feel, lying here, blinking and holding his head with his good left hand. For a second, blinking and red with AM fever, he thinks he sees ferocious Francis G. in the bedside chair, chin freshly shaved and dotted with bits of Kleenex, posture stolid, his old man's saggy little tits rising slowly under a clean white tee, smiling grimly around blue tubes and an unlit cigar between his teeth and saying,
"Well, kid, at least you're still on this side of the fucking sod. I guess there's something to be said for that there. And are you as yet sober then?"
The crocodile says coolly, disappearing and then not reappearing after several blinks. The forms and sound in the room is really only three white flaggers Gately's never known or connected with that well, but are apparently here stopping in on their way to work to show empathy and support. Bud O, and Glenn K, and Jack J. Glenn K, in daytime, wears the gray jumpsuit and complex utility belt of a refrigeration technician.
"And who's the fella in the hat outside?" he's asking.
Gately grunts in a frantic way that suggests the phoneme "ugh." Tall, well-dressed, grumpy, cocky-looking, piggy-eyed, wearing a hat, silver service-looking, black socks and brown shoes, Glenn K. says, pointing out toward the door where there's sometimes been the ominous shadow of a hat. Gately's teeth taste long, unbrushed.
"Lukin settled in for a stay, surrounded with sports pages and the takeout feuds of many cultures, laddie," says Bud O, who, the story from before Gately's time goes, once hit his wife so hard in the blackout that made him come in, he broke her nose and bent it over flat against her face, which he asked her never to have repaired as a daily visual reminder of the depths drink sunk him to. So Mrs. O had gone around with her nose bent over flat against her left cheek, but Ode tagged her with a left cross, until UHID referred her to Al-Anon, which eventually nurtured and supported Mrs. O, into eventually telling Bud O to take a flying fuck to the moon, and getting her nose realigned back out front, and leaving him for a male Al-Anon in Birkenstock sandals. Gately's bowels have gone watery with dread. He has all too clear memories of a certain remorseless Revere Assistant District Attorney's brown shoes, piggy eyes, Stetson with feather, and penchant for third world takeout. He keeps grunting pathetically. Unsure how to be supportive, for a while the flaggers try to cheer Gately up by telling him CPR jokes. CPR is their term for Al-Anon, which is known to Boston AAs as the Church of Perpetual Revenge.
"What's an Al-Anon relapse?" asked Glenn K.
"It is a twinge of compassion," says Jack J.,
who has a kind of a facial tic.
"But what is an Al-Anon salute?"
Jack J. asks back. The three all pause, and then Jack Jay puts the back of his hand to his brow and flutters his lashes martyrishly at the drop ceiling. They all three of them laugh. They have no clue that if Gately actually laughs, he'll tear his shoulders sutures. One side of Jack Jay's face goes in and out of a tortured grimace that doesn't affect the other side of his face one bit, something that's always given Gately the fantods. Bud O is waggling his finger disapprovingly at Glenn Kay to signify an Al-Anon handshake. Glenn Kay gives a lengthy impression of an Al-Anon mom watching her alcoholic kid marching in some parade and getting more and more outraged at how everybody's out of step except her kid. Gately closes his eyes and moves his chest up and down a few times in a dumb show of polite laughter, so they'll think they've cheered him up and screw. The little thoracic movements make his dextral regions make him want to bite the side of his hand in pain. It's like a big wooden spoon keeps pushing him just under the surface of sleep, and then spooning him up for something huge to taste him again and again. The 19th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. After Rami Marat and Osoweki and Babalus also, they all reported back negatively for all signs of this veiled performer. Monsieur Fortier and Marat threw into an effect this finally most drastic of the operations for the locating of the master entertainment. This was to acquire members of the immediate family of the auteur, perhaps in public. Marat was charged with this operation's details, for Monsieur Bruyme was now thrust into technical trouble-killing on the furthering field tests of viewer willingness. For one of the newly acquired test subjects, this was an eccentrically dressed and extremely irritating, without-home man of the streets, in a white wig, appropriated with large bags filled of foreign cookware and extremely small-in-size ladies' undergarments, was discovered to have been being severing and pushing beneath the room of storage's closed door the severed digits of the second of the newly acquired test subjects. This was a mistressed and severely weakened or addicted man dressed in the clothing of a gauche woman, carrying multiple purses of suspicious nature, rather than his own digits, marring the statistics of Bruyme's field experimento, such that Monsieur Fortier was forced to consider whether to allow Bruyme to conduct a lethal technical interview of the wigged substitutor of digits for reasons of anger only. Substantially, a technical interview of more importance was to be conducted in the city Phoenix, far across the U.S. to the south, a city's name Fortier had amusement from, and departed before incoming weather to attend Mademoiselle Luria P. in this conducting, leaving the trusted Rami Marat to charge details of the preliminary acquisition. Marat, who had made his decision and call, did what he could. A direct assault upon the Academy of Tennis itself was impossible. AFRs fear nothing in this hemisphere except tall and steep hillsides. Their attack must not be direct. Thus, the preliminary was to acquire and replace the tennis children of Quebec, known by the AFR to be, even then, en route to USA soil for gala competition with the tennis children of this academy. Marat selected young Babalus, the one still with both the legs, albeit paralyzed and stickishly withered, them, to lead the AFR field detail, which must intercept the provincial players. Marat, he stayed at the Cambridge shop of the Antitoire, withdrawing frequently to the jazz nights nearby of Ryle's restaurant. Babalus drove the modified van of Dodge north into the increasingly heavy snowstorm. They bypassed the Pongo checkpoint at Methuen, Massachusetts. They would place a large mirror in the deserted road and elude the tennis bus that it must leave the road to avoid impact. Its own headlights would delude it. An old FLQ trick. Two teams in the van's back assembled the mirror's components. Babalus would not allow to stop for this assembly. The snowfall was worse than the convexity because of the fans to the south. What used to be Montpelier in Vermont lay between EWD grids, but took bad fallout from the region of Champlain, and was unoccupied and ghostly white with snow. Babalus permitted at Montpelier a brief stop for final assembly, and for those who were incontinent to change their bags. Babalus pressed hard to the former place
of St. Johnsbury, where the mirror was installed across the southbound lanes of the U.S. Interstate No. 91. Bobulus did not complain that there were no tracks in the snow of the road to be followed. He never complained. They arrived well early just south of the checkpoint at which Provincial Autoroute No. 55 became the Interstate No. 91. There was a brief period of detention when it appeared that the night vision attachment for the binoculars had been misplaced. Bobulus remained cool, and it was located. The plan was to intercept the traveling team of players and allow AFRs to arrive at the place in their stead. Marat promised to conceive an excellent ruse to explain the wheelchairs and adult beards of the false players. There was no smoking in the van, while they waited for the children tennis players of their country to appear at the checkpoint. The bus was forced to remain at the checkpoint for several minutes. The bus was large and chartered and appeared warm within. Above its windshield, its lit rectangle of destination displayed the English word for charter. If the bus survived the swerve from the highway's mirror and was operational after the crash of swerving, Bobulus would drive this bus. There was one brief argument over who would be required to drive the van, for Bobulus refused to leave the van behind them even if the bus was operational. If the bus was not operational, no more than 6 junior children as survivors could be accommodated in the van. The rest would be allowed to die for Luray Pays. Bobulus, he showed no preference one or the other way. Gately dreamed he was with Ennett House resident Joelle Van Dyne in a southern motel, whose restaurant's authoritarian sign said simply, "Eat," in the U.S. South, in high summer, brutally hot, the foliage outside the room's broken window screen a parched khaki, the air glassy with heat, the ceiling fan rotating at a second-hand's rate, the room's bed a lavish four-poster, tall and squishy, the bedspread nubbly. Gately, supine, with his side on fire, while newcomer Joelle V.D. raises her veil slightly to lick the sweat off his lids and temples, whispering so the veil flutters around and fans him, promising him a PM of near-terminal pleasures, undressing at the foot of the old tall bed, slowly, her loose, light clothes moist with sweat, and falling easily to the bare floor, and an incredible female body, an inhuman body, the sort of body Gately's only ever seen with a staple in its navel, a body like something you'd win in a raffle. And a fifth post forms on the four-poster, so to speak, which erect post's long-dormant height obscures the nude newcomer's figure. And then, when she moves around out of the pulsing shadow to lean in close and press her inhuman body's face right up intimately close to his, she removes the veil. And on top of this body, to die for, is the unveiled historical likeness of fucking Winston Churchill, complete with cigar and jowls and bulldog scowl. And the ghastliness of the shock makes the rest of Gately's body go rigid, the pain of which wakes him with a jolted attempt to sit up that itself causes such a blast of pain that he half passes back out again and lies there with rolling eyes and a round mouth. Gately's also powerless over memories of the older type lady that had been their neighbor when he and his mother shared bed and board with the MP. A Mrs. Wait. There was no Mr. Wait. The smeared window of the little empty garage the MP kept his weights in was right next to the spiny neglected garden Mrs. Waite kept in the narrow strip between the two houses. Mrs. Waite's house had been, shall we say, indifferently maintained. Mrs. Waite's house had made the Gately house look like the Taj. There was something wrong about Mrs. Waite. None of the parents said what it was, but none of the kids were allowed to play in her yard or ring her bell on Halloween. Gately never got clear on what was supposed to be wrong about her, but the little poor neighborhood psyche throbbed with something dire about Mrs. Waite. Older kids drove across her lawn and shouted shit that Gately never quite made out at night. The littler kids thought they had it. They were pretty sure Mrs. Waite was a witch. Yes, she did look a little witchy.
but who over, like, 50 didn't. But the big thing was she kept jars of stuff she'd jarred herself in her little garage. Brown, green, viscous, nameless, vegetoid stuff in mayonnaise jars, stacked on steel shelves, and rusty-lidded and bearded with dust. The littler kid snuck in and broke some of the jars and stole one and ran away in mortal terror to break it elsewhere and then run again. They dared each other to ride their bikes in tiny diagonals across the edge of her lawn. They told each other stories of seeing Mrs. Waite in a pointy hat, roasting missing kids whose pictures were on milk cartons, and pouring the juice into jars. Some of the bigger littler kids even tried that inevitable gag of putting a paper bag full of dog shit on her stoop and lighting it. It was somehow a further indictment of Mrs. Waite that she never complained. She rarely left her house. Mrs. Gately would never say what was wrong about Mrs. Waite, but absolutely forbade Don to fuck with her in any way. Like Mrs. Gately was in any position to enforce any, like, forbiddings. Gately never fucked with Mrs. Waite's stored jars or rode across her lawn and never much joined in on the witch stories, which, who needed witches to fear and despise when you had the good old MP right there at the kitchen table? But he was still scared of her. When he'd once seen her gnarly-eyed face up against the smeared garage window 1 p.m., when he had left the MP to beating Mrs. Gately and gone out to lift weights, he screamed and almost dropped the bench press bar on his Adam's apple. But over the long haul of a low-stimulation North Shore childhood, he'd gradually developed a slight relationship with Mrs. Waite. He'd never all that much liked her. It wasn't like she was this lovable but misunderstood old lady. It's not like he ran to her dilapidated house to confide in her or bond. But he went over once or twice, maybe, under circumstances he'd forgot, and had sat in her kitchen, interfaced a little. She was lucid, Mrs. Waite, and apparently continent, and there was no pointy hat anywhere in sight, but her house smelled bad. And Mrs. Waite herself had swollen veiny ankles and little white bits of that dried paste at the corners of her mouth and about a million newspapers stacked and mildewing all over the kitchen, and the old lady basically radiated whatever mixture of unpleasantness and vulnerability it was that made you want to be cruel to people. Gately was never cruel to her, but it's not like he loved her or anything. When Gately went over there the couple times, it was mostly when the MP was canning chowder, and his mother had passed out in vomit she expected somebody else to clean up, and he probably wanted to act out his kid's anger by doing something Mrs. Geed pathetically tried to forbid. He didn't eat much of whatever Mrs. Waite offered. She never offered him viscous material from a jar. His memories of whatever they discussed are unspecific. She hung herself, eventually, Mrs. Waite, as in eliminated her own map. And because it was fall and cool, she wasn't found for maybe weeks after. It wasn't Gately who found her. A meter reader guy found her several weeks after Gately's 8th or 9th birthday. Gately's birthday was the same week as several other kids' in the neighborhood, by some chance. Usually, Gately'd have his party over with some of the other kids that were having their birthdays with the party. Hats and Twister, X-Men videos, cake on Chinette plates, etc. Mrs. Gately was together enough to come a couple times. In retrospect, the other kids' parents let Gately have birthdays with them because they'd felt sorry for him, he's involuntarily realized. But at some sober neighbor's party, part of which was for his own 8th or 9th birthday, he remembers how Mrs. Waite had left her house and come rung the sober neighbor's bell and had brought a birthday cake for the birthday. A neighborly gesture. Gately'd spilled the beans on the annual mass party at a kitchen table interface with her. The cake was uneven and slightly tilted to one side, but it was dark chocolate and decorated with 4 cursive names and had clearly been made with care. Mrs. Waite had spared Gately the humiliation of putting just his name on the cake as if the cake was especially for him. But it was. Mrs. Wade had saved up for a long time to afford to make the cake, Gately knew. He knew she smoked like a chimney and had given up cigarettes for weeks to save up for something. She wouldn't tell him what. She'd tried to make her scary eyes twinkle when she wouldn't tell, but he'd seen the mayonnaise jar full of quarters on a pile of papers and had wrestled with himself over promoting it and won. But there were only like 9 candles on the cake when the party's mom brought it in, and a couple of the kids having birthdays were like 12. Was the private tip-off on who the cake was really for. The party's mom had taken the cake at the door and said, "Thank you," but had neglected to invite Mrs. Waite in. Gailey was in a position during Twister in the garage to see Mrs. Waite walking back home across the street, slowly but very straightly and dignified and upright. A lot of the kids went to the garage door to look. Mrs. Waite had rarely been seen outside her house before and never off her property. The sober mom brought the cake in the garage and said it was a touching gesture from Mrs. Waite across the street, but she wouldn't let anybody eat the cake or even come close enough to it to blow out the 9 candles. The candles didn't all match. The candles burned down far enough so that there was a smell of burnt frosting before they went out. The cake sat, tilted, by itself, in a corner of the clean garage. Gately didn't defy the sober mom or any of the kids and eat a piece of the cake. He didn't even go near it. He didn't join in the delicious whispery arguments about what kind of medical waste or roasted kid renderings were in the cake. But he didn't stand up and argue with the other kids about the fact of the poisoning either. Before the party climaxed and the other kids that had got presents opened their presents, the sober mom had taken the cake into the kitchen when she thought nobody was watching, and threw it out in the wastebasket. Gately remembers the cake must have landed upside down because the unfrosted side was facing up in the wastebasket when he snuck in and had a look at the cake. Mrs. Wade had disappeared back inside her house way before the mom threw the cake away. There's no way she could have seen the mom take the uneaten cake back inside the house. A couple days later, Gately had promoted a couple packs of Benson & Hedges 100s from a store 24 and put them in Mrs. Waite's mailbox, where junk mail and utility bills were already piling up. He sometimes rang the bell, but never saw her. Her bell had been a buzzer instead of a bell, he remembers. She got found by a frustrated meter reader some indefinite number of weeks after that. The circumstances of her death and discovery became more dark myth for the littler kids. Gately wasn't so into self-torture as to think the cake getting not eaten and getting thrown out was in any way connected with Mrs. Waite hanging herself. Everybody had their own private troubles, Mrs. Gately had explained to him, and even at that age he could see her point. It's not like he'd, like, mourned Mrs. Waite, or missed her, or even thought about her, even once, for many years after that. Which is what makes it somehow worse that his next, even more unpleasant Joelle Van Dyne pain and fever dream takes place in what is unmistakably and unavoidably Mrs. Waite's kitchen in great detail, right down to the ceiling's light fixture full of dried bugs, the brimming ashtrays, the bar graph of stacked globes, the maddening arrhythmic drip of the kitchen sink and the bad smell. A mixture of mildew and putrid fruit. Gately is in the ladder back kitchen chair he used to sit in, the one with one rung broken, and Mrs. Waite is in her chair opposite, seated on the thing he thought then was a weird pink donut instead of a hemorrhoid pillow. Except in the dream, Gately's feet reach all the way to rest on the floor's dank tile, and Mrs. Waite is played by veiled UHID house resident Joelle Van D, except without her veil, and what's more, without any clothes. As in Starkers, gorgeous, with that same incredible body as in the other one, except here, this time, with the face not of a jowly British prime minister, but of a total female angel. Not sexy so much as angelic, like all the world's light had gotten together and arranged itself into the shape of a face. Or something. It looks like somebody, Joel's face, but Gately can't for the life of him place who. And it's not just the distraction of the inhumanly gorgeous naked bod below, because the dream is not like a sex dream. Because in this dream, Mrs. Waite, who is Joel, is death, as in the figure of death. Death incarnate. Nobody comes right out and says so, it's just understood. Gately sitting here in this depressing kitchen, interfacing with death. Death is explaining that death happens over and over. You have many lives, and at the end of each one, meaning life, is a woman who kills you and releases you into the next life. Gately can't quite make out if it's like a monologue or if he's asking questions and she's responding in a Q&A deal. Death says that this certain woman that kills you is always your next life's mother. This is how it works. Didn't he know? In the dream, everybody in the world seems to know this except Gately. Like, he'd missed that day in school when they covered it, and so Death's having to sit here, naked and angelic, and explain it to him, very patiently, more or less like remedial reading at Beverly High School. Death says the woman who either knowingly or involuntarily kills you is always someone you love, and she's always your next life's mother. This is why moms are so obsessively loving. Why they try so hard, no matter what private troubles or issues or addictions they have of their own, why they seem to value your welfare above their own, and why there's always a slight, like, twinge of selfishness about their obsessive mother love. They're trying to make amends for a murder neither of you quite remember, except maybe in dreams. As Death's explanation of death goes on, Gately understands really important vague stuff more and more, but the more he understands, the sadder he gets, and the sadder he gets, the more unfocused and wobbly becomes his vision of the Death's Joel sitting nude on the pink plastic ring, until, near the end, it's as if he's seeing her through a kind of cloud of light, a milky filter that's the same as the wobbly blur through which a baby sees a parental face bending over its crib, and he begins to cry in a way that hurts his chest, and asks Death to set him free and be his mother. And Joelle either shakes or nods her lovely unfocused head and says, "Wait." The 20th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Gaudiamo sigitur. I was in a zoo. There were no animals or cages, but it was still a zoo. It was close to a nightmare, and it woke me before 0500 hours. Mario was still asleep, gently lit by the window's view of tiny lights down the hill. He lay very still and soundless as always, his poor hands folded on his chest as if awaiting a lily. I put in a plug of Kodiak. His four pillows brought Mario's chin to his chest when he slept. I was still producing excess saliva, and my one pillow was moist in a way I didn't want to turn on a light and investigate. I didn't feel good at all. A sort of nausea of the head. The feeling seemed worst first thing in the morning. I'd felt for almost a week as if I needed to cry for some reason, but the tears were somehow stopping just millimeters behind my eyes and staying there, and so on. I got up and went past the foot of Mario's bed to the window to stand on one foot. Sometime during the night, heavy snow had begun to fall. I had been ordered by DeLint and Barry Loach to stand on the left foot for 15 minutes a day as therapy for the ankle. The countless little adjustments necessary to balance on one foot worked muscles and ligaments in the ankle that were therapeutically unreachable any other way. I always felt sort of dickish standing on one foot in the dark with nothing to do. The snow on the ground had a purple cast to it, but the falling and whirling snow was virgin white. Yachting cap white. I stood on my left foot for maybe 5 minutes tops. The boards and APs were 3 weeks from tomorrow at 0800 in the CBS auditorium at BU.
344. 345.
I could hear a night custodial crew rolling a mop bucket somewhere on another floor. This was to be the first AM without dawn drills since Interdependence Day, and everybody was invited to sleep in until breakfast. There were to be no classes all weekend. I'd awakened too early yesterday, too. I'd kept seeing Kevin Bain crawling my way in my sleep. I straightened up my bed and put the pillows wet side down and put on clean sweatpants and some socks that didn't smell foul. The closest Mario comes to snoring is a thin sound he makes at the back of his throat. The sound is as if he's drawing out the word key over and over. It's not an unpleasant sound. I estimated a good 50 centimeters of snow on the ground, and it was really coming down. And the purple half-light, the West Court's nets were half-buried. Their top halves shuddered in a terrible wind. All over the sub-dormitory I could hear doors rattling slightly in their frames, as they did only in a bad wind. The wind gave the snowfall a swirling diagonal aspect. Snow was hitting the exterior of the window with a sandy sound. The basic view outside the window was that of a briskly shaken paperweight, the kind with the Xmas diorama and shakable snow. The grounds, trees, fences, and buildings looked toy-like and miniaturized somehow. In fact, it was hard to distinguish new snow falling from extant snow simply whirling around in the wind. It only then occurred to me to wonder whether and where we would play today's exhibition meet. The lung wasn't yet up, but the 16 courts under the lung wouldn't have accommodated more than an A-only meet anyway. A kind of cold hope flared in me because I realized this could be cancellation weather. The backlash of this hope was an even worse feeling than before. I couldn't remember ever actively hoping not to have to play before. I couldn't remember feeling strongly one way or the other about playing for quite a long time, in fact. Mario and I had begun to make a practice of keeping the phone console's power on at night but turning off the ringer. The console's digital recorder had a light that pulsed once for each incoming message. The double flash of the recorder's light set up an interesting interference pattern with the red battery light on the ceiling's smoke detector, the two lights flashing in sync on every seventh phone flash, and then moving slowly apart in a visual Doppler. A formula for the temporal relation between two unsyncopated flashes would translate spatially into the algebraic formula for an ellipse, I could see. Pemulus had poured a terrific volume of practical pre-boards math into my head for 2 weeks, taking his own time and not asking for anything in return, being almost suspiciously generous about it. Then, since the Wayne debacle, the little tutorials had ceased, and Pemulus himself had been very scarce, twice missing meals and several times taking the truck for long periods without checking with any of the rest of us about our truck needs. I didn't even try to factor in the rapid single flash of the phone's power unit display on the side of the TP. This would make it some sort of calculus thing, and even Pemulus, I conceded that I was not hardwired for anything past algebra and conic sections. Every November, between Interdependence Day and the Whataburger Invitational in Tucson, Arizona, the Academy holds a semi-public exhibition meet for the benefit of ETA's patrons and alumni and friends in the Boston area. The exhibition is followed by a semi-formal cocktail party and dance in the dining hall, where players are required to appear, showered and semi-formal, and available for social intercourse with patrons. Some of them all but check our teeth. Last year, Heath Pearson had appeared for the gala in a red vest and bellboy's cap and furry tail, carrying a little organ and inviting patrons to grind the organ while he capered around, chattering. CT was unamused. The whole fundraiser is a Charles Tavis innovation. CT is far better at public relations and pump priming than was himself. The exhibition and gala are possibly the climax of CT's whole administrative year. He determined that mid-November was the best time for a fundraiser, with the weather not yet bad, and the tax year drawing to a close, but the U.S. holiday season, with its own draining system of demands on goodwill, not yet underway. For the past 3 fiscal years, the fundraiser's proceeds have all but paid for the spring's Southeast Tour and the European Terre Battue Fest of June-July. The exhibition meet involved both genders, A and B teams, and was always against some foreign junior squad to give the whole fundraising affair a patriotic kicker. The gentle fiction was that the meet was just one stop for the foreign squad and a whole vague general U.S. tour. But in truth, CT usually flew the foreigners in special, and at some expense. We had in the past done battle with teams from Wales, Belize, the Sudan, and Mozambique. Cynics might point to an absence of tennis juggernauts among the opponents. Last year's Mozambique thing was a particular turkey shoot, 70-2. And there'd been an ugly, xeno-racist mood among some of the spectators and patrons, a couple of whom cheerily compared the meet to Mussolini's tanks rolling over Ethiopian spear chuckers. YDAU's opponents were to be the Quebec Junior Davis and Junior Whiteman Cup teams, and their arrival from MIA Dorval
346
was keenly anticipated by Strzok and Freer, who claimed that the Quebecois Junior Whiteman girls were normally sequestered and saw very few co-ed venues and would be available for broadening intercultural relations of all kinds. It was improbable that anything was going to be landing on time at Logan in this kind of snow, though. The wind also produced a desolate moaning in all the ventilation ducts. Mario said, "Key," and sometimes, "Ski," drawing them out. It occurred to me that without some one-hitters to be able to look forward to smoking alone in the tunnel, I was waking up every day feeling as though there was nothing in the day to anticipate or lend anything any meaning. I stood on one foot for a couple more minutes, spitting into a coffee can I'd left on the floor near the phone from the night before. The implied question, then, would be whether the Bob Hope had somehow become not just the high point of the day, but its actual meaning. That would be pretty appalling. The pen 4 that was my hand-strengthening ball for November was on the sill against the window. I'd neither carried nor squeezed my ball for several days. No one seemed to have noticed. Mario cedes me full control over the phone's ringer and answering machine, since he has trouble holding the receiver, and the only messages he ever gets are in-house ones from the moms. I enjoyed leaving different outgoing messages on the machine, but I refused ever to back the messages with music or digitally altered bits of entertainment. None of the ETA phones was video-capable, another CT decision. Under CT, the Academy's manual of honor codes, rules, and procedures had almost tripled in length. Probably our room's best message ever was Ortho Stice doing his deadly CT impression, taking 80 seconds to list possible reasons why Mario and I couldn't answer the phone, and outlining our probable reactions to all possible caller emotions provoked by our unavailability. But at 80 seconds, the thing wore thin after a while. Our outgoing this week was something like, "This is the disembodied voice of Hal Incandenza, whose body is not now able," and so on. And then the standard invitation to leave a message. It was honesty and abstinence week, after all, and this seemed a more truthful message to leave than the pedestrian, "This is Hal Incandenza," since the caller would pretty obviously be hearing a digital recording of me rather than me. This observation owed a debt to Pemulus, who for years, and with several different roommates, has retained the same recursive message. "This is Mike Pemulus's answering machine's answering machine. Mike Pemulus's answering machine regrets being unavailable to take a first-order message for Mike Pemulus, but if you'll leave a second-order message at the sound of the clapping hand, Mike Pemulus's answering machine will..." And so on. Which is worn so thin that very few of Pemulus's friends or customers can abide waiting through the tired thing to leave a message, which Pemulus finds congenial, since no really relevant caller would be fool enough to leave his name on any machine of Pemulus's anyway. Plus, it was also creepy that when the face's effulgence becomes the boiled white of the trauma wing ceiling as he comes up with a start for air, the apparently real, non-dream, Joel Van D is leaning over the bed's crib railing, wetting Gately's big forehead and horror-rounded lips with a cool cloth, wearing sweatpants and a sort of loose brocaded hopal whose lavender almost matches the selvage on her clean veil. The hopal's neckline is too high for there to be much cleavage action as she leans over him, which Gately regards as probably kind of a mercy. The two brownies Joelle's got in her other hand, and her nails are bitten down to the ragged quick, just like Gately's, she says she liberated from the nurse's station and brought down for him, since Morris H. meant them for him, and thereby all just rights his. But she can see he's in no shape to swallow, she says. She smells like peaches and cotton. And there's a sweet, evil whiff of the discount Canadian gaspers so many of the residents smoke, and underneath those smells, Gately can detect that she's got on a bit of perfume.
347.
To amuse him, she says, "and low," several times. Gately makes his chest go up and down rapidly to signify amusement. He declines either to moo or mew at her, out of embarrassment. Her veil this morning has a springy light purple around the border, and the hair framing the veil seems a darker red, duskier, than when she'd first come into the house and refused meat. Gately hadn't been much into WYYY or Madam Psychosis, but he'd sometimes run into people who were. Organics men, mostly. Opium and brown heroin. Terrible mulled wine. And he feels on top of the febrile pain and the creepiness of the amphetamidic wraith and Winston Churchill face Joel and angelic maternal death Joel dreams, an odd vividness in himself at being swabbed and maybe even generally admired by someone who's an underground local intellectual-art-type celebrity. He doesn't know how to explain it, like as if the fact that she's a public personage makes him feel somehow physically actuated, like more their feeling. Conscious of the way he's holding his face, hesitant to make his barnyard sounds, even breathing through his nose, so she won't smell his unbrushed teeth. He feels self-conscious with her, Joel can tell. But what's admirable is he has no idea how heroic or even romantic he looks, unshaven and intubated, huge and helpless, wounded in service to somebody who did not deserve service. Half out of his tree from pain and refusing narcotics. The last and pretty much only man Joelle ever let herself admire in a romantic way had left and wouldn't even face up to why, instead erecting for himself a pathetic, jealous fantasy about Joelle and his own poor father, whose only interest in Joelle had been first aesthetic and then anti-aesthetic. Joel doesn't know that newly sober people are awfully vulnerable to the delusion that people with more sober time than them are romantic and heroic, instead of clueless and terrified and just muddling through day by day like everybody else in AA is, except maybe the fucking crocodiles. Joel says she can't stay long this time. All non-working residents have to report for the house's AM daily meditation meeting, as Gately knows only too well. He isn't sure what she means by this time. She describes the newest male resident's weird limbo injury posture and the way Jeanette Fultz has to cut up this Dave guy's supper and drop it into his open mouth bit by bit like a bird with a chick. Lifting her face to the ceiling makes the linen veil conform to the features of the face below, mouth open wide in imitation of a chick. The crew-neckish hullop makes her hair's loose curls look dark, and her wrists and hands look pale. Her hands' skin is taut and freckled and treed with veins. His bed's metal bars keep Gately's rolling eyes from seeing anything much south of her thorax, until Joel finishes with the washcloth and retreats to the edge of the other bed, which at some point has become empty, and the crying guy's chart removed,
and its crib railings folded down, and she sits on the edge of the bed and crosses her legs, supporting one Warachi's heel on the railing's joint, revealing she's